Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Jill Robbins, and Dan Novak. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
As people prepare to visit family and friends during the holiday season, some might be wondering whether it is safe to travel during the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Experts and public health officials say it is currently safe for many people to travel, but they continue to urge everyone to carefully follow proven safety measures to limit virus spread. In its latest safety guidelines, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention urges people who are not fully vaccinated to delay travel during the holiday season. Unvaccinated people who do not travel should wear well-fitting face masks while attending holiday events taking place in indoor settings, the CDC says. It also says that even fully vaccinated individuals should wear face coverings in indoor settings in communities known to have high infection rates. Unvaccinated people who decide to travel should get a COVID-19 test 1 to 3 days before travel and 3 to 5 days after returning. The coronavirus coordinator for the White House, Jeff Zients, says about 59% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated against COVID-19. Children ages 5 to 11 were approved for the vaccine earlier this month. As of last week, 2.6 million children had gotten their first of 2 shots, Zients said. That is about 10% of children eligible to get vaccinated. Dr. Keith Armitage is an infectious disease expert at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. He told the Associated Press that all travelers should avoid indoor events with unmasked crowds. The Delta variant has really brought us back to an earlier time in the pandemic, Armitage said. There is no requirement for COVID-19 vaccination or testing for Americans flying within the country. But the CDC says all travelers must still wear masks on trains, planes, and in other indoor public transportation areas. Armitage said hotels do not present a large risk for vaccinated individuals as long as they wear masks around people they do not know. He noted that family gatherings with unvaccinated people can be more problematic, especially for those who are older or have health problems. Health experts suggest looking at the case levels and masking rules in the places people plan to visit before they travel. Many Americans already started their holiday travel plans last week. The Transportation Security Administration said last Friday, November 19th, was the single busiest air travel day since March 2020. The agency said it processed 2.24 million travelers on that day. I'm Brian Lynn.
Concerns about Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai in the past week have raised questions about similar cases in China. Well-known people have disappeared for periods after criticizing Chinese Communist Party leaders. The Associated Press looked at some of those cases. Here are a few of them. Chinese officials have not answered an accusation in social media by international tennis champion Peng Shuai more than 2 weeks ago. Peng accused Zhang Gaoli of sexual wrongdoing. He is a former vice premier and member of the party's powerful Politburo Standing Committee. The social media post with the accusation was quickly deleted from her account on Weibo, a leading Chinese social media service. But images of the accusation quickly spread across China's internet. Peng is 35 and a former top-ranked player in women's tennis. She also competed in three Olympics. Concerns began when she did not appear in public for more than a week after her message was deleted. Peng appeared at a youth tennis game over the weekend and talked with the head of the International Olympic Committee in a video call on Sunday. China says it is a nation ruled by law, but the Communist Party makes the decisions and there is uneven enforcement of laws. Control over the press and social media permits officials to hide disappearances and to block critics. However, such news often comes out in time through underground and foreign reports. Since it took power in 1949, the Chinese Communist Party has imprisoned people without charges, sometimes for years. The party's Central Commission for Discipline Inspection deals with most major charges against ranking officials. Later, an announcement may say they are under investigation for severe violations of rules and regulations. Heavy sentences are later announced, with little or no details given about the charges or the evidence brought against the targets. Well-known people who have dropped out of sight for unknown reasons include business leader Jack Ma and famous actor Fan Bingbing. Ma is China's best-known business person and the founder of Alibaba Group, the world's biggest online seller of goods and services. Ma stopped appearing in public after he criticized regulators as being too conservative in an October 2020 speech. Days later, the government ordered Ma's Ant Group Financial Service to stop plans to sell stock on exchanges in Hong Kong and Shanghai. Ma was seen 2 months later in a video released by Alibaba in January 2021. He said nothing about his disappearance. He appeared again in October in Hong Kong. Popular actor Fan Bingbing disappeared for 3 months before the news was released that tax officials said she and her companies owed $130 million. She told reporters the following year about the experience. "It has made me calm down and think seriously about what I want to do in my future life." Businessperson Duan Weihong, who was also known as Whitney Duan, disappeared in 2017. She had talked to the New York Times in 2012 about the family wealth of then-premier Wen Jiabao. Wen is China's number two leader. Her husband, Desmond Shum, is a writer. He said he did not hear from her for 4 years until he was preparing to publish a book about corruption among Chinese officials. Shum told Time magazine his wife asked him in a phone call not to publish his book, Red Roulette. I'm Jill Robbins.
American students have experienced a worldwide health crisis, nationwide protests, and school closings and restrictions over the past 2 years. But art classes in schools have helped some students deal with their emotions and difficulties. Teachers have used art and the humanities to teach complex subjects like racism. Students at Sullivan High School in Chicago, for example, wrote poetry and made pictures about subjects like imprisonment and slavery for a project based on the New York Times 1619 Project. Art classes like painting and drawing, as well as music and acting classes, provide a way for students to express themselves. The art or music room can also provide students an escape from the tensions of the school day, educators say. I remember students that only felt comfortable in the band room, said Gary Main. He was speaking to the nonprofit organization Music for All, based in Indianapolis, Indiana. Main is a behavioral expert and former music teacher. And the coolest thing about what we do for a living is we ask kids to sit in a room and express their feelings through music. Some experts say art classes provide a way to teach social and emotional learning. Social and emotional learning deals with finding a way for students to control their emotions, have relationships with others, and show empathy. Many schools place a lot of attention on social and emotional learning. This could be because students' mental health has become more of a concern following the coronavirus pandemic. Art educators, more so than most, they see kids for multiple years, Maurice Elias told Chalkbeat, a nonprofit news provider. Elias is head of the Rutgers University Social Emotional and Character Development Lab in New Jersey. They build strong relationships and connections with the kids. They have a tremendous influence on their mental health. Sarah Potpinka teaches 8 subjects as the only art teacher at Putnam High School in Connecticut. When classes went online, she asked her photography students to take pictures of how their lives had changed. Her drawing and painting students also made pieces reacting to the pandemic. Many of her students' work was filled with rage, Potpinka told VOA. One student who saw school as an escape from home life was unable to leave home during the pandemic. Through artwork, she was able to express herself, but it was also a way for her teachers to see where she was at mentally, since I wasn't hearing from her very often. The troubling work from the student led to a discussion which would involve school mental health experts. Potpinka said her art classes are often a decompression time for students. She said her school system is in a poor part of Connecticut. Many of her students care for younger relatives or work part-time jobs to provide their family with extra money. Potpinka said one of her high school students recently had a child and had a difficult home life even before the pandemic. Potpinka said he is involved with the baby's life, but he is struggling with his schoolwork and at risk of dropping out, as school is no longer important to him. The student has taken a strong interest in designing tattoo art. Tattoos are ink pictures drawn on a person's skin that are permanent. He has asked Potpinka for materials so he could work on his drawings outside of class. He can balance what he's been struggling with academically with some success in the art room, Potpinka said. It's nice to see him still working on something that captures him. Shauna Longo is a longtime music teacher in New Jersey. She told Music for All that teaching music is a way for students to have fun while exploring their personalities. She said that in many years' time, her students may not remember the notes to a song, but they're going to remember how they felt, and that, to me, is of utmost importance. I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On March 4th, 1865, Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as president after winning a second term. The election had taken place in the Union of Northern States. The Union still followed the United States Constitution. The Confederacy of Southern States had left the Union. The South had its own constitution. On the evening of Inauguration Day, the White House was open to the public. The party ended near midnight. Thousands of people went to see President Lincoln. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of President Lincoln and the American Civil War.
Lincoln was glad the celebrations were over. Now he could get back to the urgent problems that faced him. He hoped that during his second four-year term, he could end the Civil War. He hoped he could ease the bitterness and hatred the war had brought. Lincoln hoped for an easy peace. He wanted no hangings or other brutal acts against the losers. He wanted to see Confederate soldiers go back to their homes to become peaceful citizens of a united country. Lincoln wanted the nation to grow together again.
The war could not last much longer. The South already was defeated, but Confederate leaders refused to accept defeat. General Robert E. Lee's army still held the area around Richmond, Virginia. Richmond was the Confederate capital. Lee did not believe, however, that he could hold the city much longer. His once mighty army now had less than 50,000 men. These men were tired and hungry, and they had to defend a line almost 60 kilometers long from Richmond to the city of Petersburg. There just were not enough Confederate soldiers left to fight.
Lee decided that his only hope was to give up the two cities. He would march south and join General Joe Johnston's army in North Carolina. Perhaps the two armies could defeat Union forces moving up through the state. Then they could turn to meet the army of General Ulysses Grant. This plan had little chance of success, but it would keep the Confederate armies active for a few more weeks or months. Lee soon discovered that it would not be easy to break out of the trap that Richmond and Petersburg had become. Grant's army seemed to be everywhere. Lee put 11,000 of his men into position near Grant's line. They waited for the enemy to attack. At first, the Confederates received some help from the weather. Heavy rains fell for more than a day. Many roads and fields were flooded. The Union Army could not move forward. When it did, the Confederates were ready. They pushed back the attackers.
The victory did not last long. There were five times more Union soldiers than Confederate soldiers. The Confederates fought hard, but could not stop them. They were forced to withdraw. The Confederates moved slowly, then more quickly, as Union troops chased them. They began to flee wildly. About half of them were captured. Grant ordered an immediate attack all along Lee's line. He was sure the line was weak. He was sure he could break it. A Union Army doctor watched the battle from a distance. He said he could see the flash of light from Confederate guns along a line a kilometer long. After a while, part of the line went dark. Then another part, and another. Flashes of gunfire became fewer. Finally, all of the line was dark. The doctor said he knew then that the Confederate line had fallen.
General Grant had been trying to break General Lee's line for almost a year. Now he had done it. His troops raced forward to seize the railroad. Lee no longer had a way to supply his troops in Petersburg. He no longer had a quick way to move his army south. He would have to move west first, then turn south. This meant he would have to give up Richmond. The government of the Confederacy would have to go with him or be captured. Confederate President Jefferson Davis gave the order to go.
Southern soldiers began to burn military supplies they could not take from Richmond. Huge amounts of shells and gunpowder were exploded. The fires got out of control. Many buildings burned to the ground. The streets were filled with refugees trying to escape the burning city. Mobs broke into stores looking for food. Union troops quickly moved into Richmond. Then they raised the United States flag over the once proud capital of the Confederacy.
President Lincoln visited Richmond on April 4th. He visited the Confederate State House, where the rebel Congress had met. He had lunch in the Confederate White House, where Confederate President Jefferson Davis had lived. Everywhere Lincoln went, hundreds of people crowded around him. Blacks, especially, wanted to get near him. They wanted to touch the man who had made them free. At no time was any kind of hostile act made against the president.
In the next few days, Lincoln followed carefully Grant's campaign against Lee's withdrawing army. By telegraph and messenger, he was informed of every move. Lee's men marched without food. They did not have time to search for it. They could not stop. The Union Army was only a day behind them. On and on they marched, many of them, weak from hunger and tired beyond belief, could go no farther. They left the road to sleep, Most never got back. Others continued to march. But many threw down their guns and equipment. Union forces attacked the moving line when they... There were battles at such places as Amelia Courthouse, Sailor's Creek, High Bridge, and Farmville. Lee's army fought off each attack, but it was slowly bleeding and starving to death.
Lee asked one of his officers to report on the situation. "There is no situation," the officer said. "Nothing remains, General Lee, but to put your poor soldiers on their poor horses and send them home in time to plant the spring crops." Lee answered, "What would the country think of me if I did that?" "Country?" the officer cried. "There is no country. You are the country to these men. They have fought for you, without pay or food. There are still thousands of us who will die for you."
On April 7th, General Grant sent a message to General Lee. He said it was hopeless to continue the struggle. He asked for the surrender of Lee's army. Lee did not agree that the situation was hopeless. He believed there was still one small chance to escape. He wanted to reach a place called Appomattox Station. There, his men could get food. Then they could march to Lynchburg, where a railroad would carry them south to safety. But the Union Army reached Appomattox Station first. Lee and his officers decided to make a final effort to break out of the circle of Union forces. If their plan failed, Lee would have no other choice. He would have to surrender.
Lee rose early on the appointed day. He put on a new gray coat and a bright red sash. He looked as if he were going to a parade. His officers wondered. Then Lee explained, "I probably will be General Grant's prisoner. I thought I should look my best." At sunrise, Lee arrived on a hill outside the town of Appomattox Courthouse. He looked down on what was to be his final battlefield. His men fought hard and well, but they could not break through the Union line. Finally, Lee said, "There is nothing left me but to go see General Grant, and I would rather die 1,000 deaths. Lee was sure Grant would not demand unconditional surrender. He said, "Grant will give us good terms, as good as we have the right to demand. I can surrender this army on the condition that its members will never fight again." Lee turned his horse toward the enemy lines behind his army. He sent a message to General Grant. It said, "I now request to meet with you at such time and place as you may name to discuss the terms of the surrender of this army."
The place would be a home in a town called Appomattox Courthouse.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.